In 2020, Disney Plus was tops for original streamed movies. This year, Netflix and HBO Max are coming for its movie crown. AT&T throws in the towel on vMVPDs, but it could have been so different. To find out why, listen on.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Video News Endscreen Media Podcast. This is Will Richmond from Video News, and Colin Dixon from Endscreen Media is with me. Hi there, Colin. How are you?
I'm doing very well, despite all the shenanigans going on in Washington, D.C. I'm managing to stay focused on our business. I don't know how, but I am.
Yeah, well, you were attending some CES sessions. We were just talking about some panels earlier.
I did, and there were some very interesting panels, and one in particular I think caught both of our eye, which was the panel given by Nielsen. And you wrote about some of the data, I wrote about it, so I think we're going to chat about that for a little bit today. So why don't you kick us off and tell us what caught your eye from that Nielsen data?
Yeah, we were both intrigued by the Nielsen data that was released this week, which basically recapped the streaming, the hours of streaming, I should say minutes of streaming in 2020 for original TV shows, licensed TV shows, and movies. And I think there were really three main themes that emerged. The first is Netflix's complete domination of both original and licensed TV shows. So Netflix had, of those two top 10 lists, they had 19 of those entries. The only one that they that was not theirs was The Mandalorian, which was on Disney Plus, and that was in the the fifth most watched original TV show of stream TV show of 2020, with 14.5 billion minutes streamed. But the big winner was The Office, and probably no surprise, I think we both know that that's been hugely popular. And of course, Peacock made a lot of, created a lot of excitement about reclaiming The Office. It's now launched as of January 1st on Peacock, the first two seasons on the free tier of Peacock, and the subsequent seasons on the Peacock premium service tier, which I think is really the main way. I think The Office is really kind of the main way that Peacock is going to be looking to generate subscribers on the premium tier. But The Office was responsible for over 57 billion minutes, streamed minutes, across its 192 episodes on Netflix in 2020. And again, that was by far the most streamed show. Number two after it was Grey's Anatomy with 39 billion minutes streamed. Then Criminal Minds, also again, these are all on Netflix, Criminal Minds with 35.4 billion. And then we have, and then actually Ozark, which is the first original, the top rated original, had 30.4 billion minutes. So I think that's really the big takeaway there is Netflix domination, The Office by far the biggest winner. And then on the movie side, it was really a kind of a split between Disney Plus and Netflix, but Disney Plus benefited because kids movies were eight of the top 10 most streamed movies of 2020. And of course, that's a sweet spot for Disney Plus. And Frozen 2 was the most streamed movie, 14.9 billion minutes, followed by Moana at 10.5 billion. Both of those were Disney Plus movies. Then Secret Life of Pets 2, which was a Netflix movie, had 9.1 billion minutes. So anyway, I think that's kind of like the top line is Netflix, The Office, and kids movies dominated 2020 streaming. And I'll just say real quickly that the Nielsen data, this comes from their SVOD content ratings service. It does only measure four SVOD services, Netflix, Amazon Prime, Disney Plus, and Hulu. So we don't know what the viewership was across some of the other popular SVOD services. So just take that with a caveat. But, you know, I think those numbers have pretty strong integrity because those are the four biggest services.
Yeah, I do too. And it's really surprising that Hulu and Prime Video didn't get anything in those top 10 lists, Will. It's really surprising. So we were chatting just before we got going on the podcast. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is, given how powerful The Office is, what sort of impact it's going to have on Peacock, because it's shifted there. I think the first two seasons of The Office are available for free ad-supported, but that's not going to satisfy the Real Office fans, Will. To get the other seasons, you're going to have to subscribe at the $6 a month level. And I wonder if that's going to really be successful in getting people to pony up to the premium tier. Now, I know what has worked, at least according to NBC, is they've been able to capture a lot of soccer fans because all the Premier League games are available on the premium tier on Peacock. I wonder if this is going to begin to capture a broader audience to the premium service, because certainly data that Real Good has been passing to me, Real Good's a streaming guide service that's got about 2 million people using it, they suggest that the majority of viewing on Peacock remains advertising supported. And of course, they would love to get people into that dual service model at that lowest subscription level. But what do you think? Do you think this is going to get people to subscribe at that lowest tier? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, it remains to be seen. And also worth keeping in mind that Xfinity TV and Flex subscribers, both get free access, or access included, I should say, to Peacock Premium with their Flex or Xfinity TV service. So that'll diminish the number of paying subscribers as well. But I have to say, looking at the Peacock marketing and looking at the Peacock website, they have The Office out there front and center. I mean, it's almost like the Peacock has been transformed into The Office since January 1st when it launched. They have focused on it almost exclusively, I think, in their marketing efforts. So it's a big bet by Peacock. And I think the Netflix numbers, I think, bear out to some extent the popularity of that show and why it was really, it is a game changer, I think, for Peacock. We'll wait and see how big of a game changer it is, but I think it's a total game changer in terms of putting that service on people's radar.
Yeah, me too. The other interesting thing about Netflix and Disney Plus that really stuck out for me was, yeah, Netflix has done a really great job, I think, of associating in people's minds the idea that they're the place to go for originals. And that sent me scurrying to look for some Hub Entertainment research data that they put out last year. And this really confirms it, Will. What they said was they asked the survey group, how many original shows does this provider produce compared to others? And Netflix, about 75% of Netflix users did have an opinion on the originals in that service, and 62% thought Netflix had more originals than others. Now, 63% had an opinion about Disney Plus on originals, but only 32% of those, a much smaller group, thought that it had more originals than others. So I think Netflix has done an absolutely super job in associating its name in people's minds with the idea that they produced the most originals and is the place to go to originals. So that was the first thing that really stuck out for me in that data, Will. The other thing was, I really think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens with the movie portion of the equation that Nielsen laid out, because Disney really did so much dominate that. Seven of the top 10 movies were Disney movies in their top 10 list. But boy, both Netflix and HBO Max, they want to make a big dent in that. Netflix has said that they plan to deliver 70 movies this year, 52 of them in English. So that's basically one a month, one a week. For the next year, we're going to have a new movie on Netflix. And boy, did you see the talent. They've really tapped a lot of Hollywood talent for this. They've got Adam McKay directing a movie called Don't Look Up with Leonardo DiCaprio, which I think is his first streaming movie. Jennifer Lawrence, Kate Blanchett, Chris Evans, Meryl Streep. There are a whole bunch of other stars like Dwayne Johnson, Gal Gadot, Idris Elba, Denzel Washington. I mean, they're really pulling in a lot of big name actors to create a very interesting suite of movies this year. But it's not just them, Will. As we know, Warner Media has made a commitment that all Warner Brothers movies that were slated to be released in theaters are going to be simultaneously released in HBO Max. Now, they'll probably be released under the same conditions as Wonder Woman 1984 was available for 30 days, and it was released on December 25th. But you know, we've got Dune. We've been waiting for that movie forever. It's been put off and put off and put off. Well, now we know it's going to come out on HBO Max sometime this year. Matrix 4, Godzilla versus King Kong. There's even a Tom and Jerry movie coming out, which should be interesting. And Mortal Kombat. So they've really got some of their top stuff is coming out through HBO Max. So I got a feeling that when we look at this list in 2022, looking back at 2021, I have a feeling Disney is not going to dominate quite so much as they did in 2020. What do you think? Does any of that sound interesting to you? Are you going to be watching?
Yeah,
some?
Yeah, I think that's right. We know that Netflix has been increasing its focus on movies over the past couple of years, but the announcement that they're going to have the 70 movies next year, releasing one per week or more, it's really amazing. And you know, just as we were talking about the Hub research identifying people's attitudes toward who has the most original content, whose brand is associated with that, and Netflix really coming out on top, this current year could change people's perceptions of which service has the most movies. And you know, studios outside of the Disney studios, the animation studios, have not historically had a ton of brand awareness. You know, it's not like people say, oh, that's a Universal movie or that's a Paramount movie. But this could be a year where people really associate a specific movie with the service, with Netflix, just as you said that they did with the original TV shows. So it could be quite a change, and that, of course, is going to be happening against the backdrop of COVID and theaters still operating at reduced capacity here for, I don't know, the foreseeable future. Don't you think?
I think you're right. And you know, the other thing, we're in the middle of the virtual CES, or at least today's the last day of the virtual CES. I tell you, who's probably really happy about all of this movie activity online, Will? And that's the TV makers, because they have a raft of new TVs coming out with 4K, high dynamic range, you know, really great looking TVs. I wonder if this is going to spark a round of people upgrading their televisions to get closer to a movie experience. I know I'm certainly looking forward to watching some of these movies in HDR. And this could have an impact on Netflix as well, because remember, you don't get 4K HDR movies unless you're subscribing to the upper tier of Netflix, which is $17.99, I think, these days. So it could end up generating more revenue for Netflix. I tell you what, though, one thing I didn't know this, Will, and I don't know if our listeners know this either. HBO Max does not support 4K HDR today. So I was really surprised to read that, bearing in mind, you know, their mantra is quality, particularly, yeah. You know, some of their things like Game of Thrones, they look so great. They're not available in 4K through that service because it doesn't support it. So,
yeah. And the fact that they're releasing some of these big budget movies directly onto HBO Max. And
exactly.
That's another, really seems, diminishes the experience.
It really seems out of step, doesn't it? I'm really surprised that they haven't done this. So hopefully they're accelerating the addition of 4K HDR support in the service so that we can enjoy these movies in as close to theater experience as possible.
Yeah. Well, let's pivot here, Colin, and the back half of the podcast. We wanted to talk about news this week that AT&T has decided to sunset the AT&T TV Now virtual pay TV service, which they launched probably about 4.5 years ago now, and actually got itself up to almost 2 million subscribers at one point before AT&T just basically said, we don't want to have anything more to do with it. And they significantly reduced the promotion around it. It had been bundled with their wireless service for a while. And then they introduced AT&T TV, which is more of a conventional service. And this week they announced once and for all that they're going to, it's about 680,000 subscribers now to AT&T TV Now, that they are dropping it entirely. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think we've passed comments on AT&T's treatment of DirecTV Now, or as it became AT&T TV Now, quite a lot. It was very clear that they weren't very impressed with that service. But I got to tell you what, it did not start out that way. So when they launched the service, John Stankey, who at the time was head of AT&T Entertainment, not CEO. This was back in, I think, 2016 is when they launched the service. And he was talking about it. And he said, and this is what he said, really. He said, it's really important to understand this is the foundation of how we're going to do things in the future. For the first time in history, we have control of our full stack. But boy, it did not take long for things to change. Now, back then, they launched at a very aggressive $35. They had 100 channels. They included sports. The, you know, ESPN was there. Fox Sports was there as well. And I think even some of the other sports channels were also included in that. And by my calculation, it was making a pretty big loss just paying for the content. But boy, they certainly got four square behind it with lots of promotions. And as you say, got up to just a little shy of 2 million. I think it was 1.9 million subscribers at its peak. But around about that time, boy, the shine definitely had come off the apple. They started talking about how it was wrong-sized, how they needed to get costs in check. I think the CEO, Randall Stevenson, at the time said, we've asked the DirecTV Now product to do too much work, so we're thinning out the content, cutting the price point, and cutting it to where it's profitable, he said. One of the things that they said that they wanted to do was they wanted to get what they called engagement pricing. And what that was, they wanted to pay content providers based on how much the channels were actually watched. So they got all excited about this engagement pricing. And I remember writing about it and at the time and just saying, well, this is a non-starter. Nobody would accept it. And indeed, nobody did accept it. So right after that, when they couldn't reduce their costs, they just stopped all promotion, increased the price, cut the channels, and as we know, the exodus began of consumers. So it's a pretty, I guess it's an inevitable end for this service, bearing in mind that it was never at that price or even twice that price with that number of channels. It was still a marginally profitable product. But it's a couple of things that really stuck out for me. One is this messy transition. They gave no details of what's going to happen to the 683,000 people that are being transitioned, except to say that they could continue to access the tiers that they had at the price that they are paying. But that won't last for long, I'm sure. I'm sure there'll be a transition period where they try and nudge them onto AT&T TV, which they probably won't want to go to because they have to make a 2-year commitment for and is more expensive. But the other thing is all of this messing around with AT&T TV Now, DirecTV Now, really, I think, blinded them to some really good opportunities. And talking about CES 2021, I listened to a session with the CEO of Philo, Andrew McCollum. He was talking about how Philo is actually doing pretty well now. And Philo, which was launched about a year after, I think, DirecTV Now, had a very different approach. They said, we're going to go after the entertainment consumers. We're not going to include sports. We're not going to include locals. And we're not going to include news. So they launched, I think, with 37 entertainment channels for a very reasonable $16 a month. And I did a calculation at how much that content was costing. And it looked to me like it was probably making a profit at $16 a month. Not much, but making some profit. And, you know, it's actually done pretty well. Philo says it's now got about 800,000 subscribers. They're paying $20 a month. And that, I think, really emphasizes that there were opportunities at the time AT&T was getting into this business world. And I just don't think they took the time to look and analyze the market properly. And they could have launched something, I think, that would have built a profitable business, maybe not would have got to 1.9 million subscribers, but would have built a profitable business for them and would have been interesting to consumers. And they'd be, you know, be adding, yeah, getting a lot of incremental revenue from it.
Yeah, yeah, I hear you. And as you said in your piece, it seemed like a naive approach, the whole idea of engagement pricing, as you said. That completely broke with industry standards, and there was no reason to believe that other TV networks were going to go along with that idea. And as you also noted, the $35, they were clearly upside down given the cost of the 100 channels that they were carrying. So that wasn't sustainable. And as we've seen with the other services that launched as, quote, skinny bundles, they've you know, adopted an approach where they've basically continued raising the price, but they've also continued adding the channels.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're really, I think, relatively close now to being conventional pay TV services, except delivered over the top. So yeah, there's no equipment, there's no set-top box, there's no truck rolls, there isn't a physical DVR, it's all in the cloud, et cetera. But, you know, AT&T took a different approach where they priced very aggressively but included all the channels up front. And no doubt as they ran into more and more financial trouble with the acquisition then of Time Warner and the debt load and everything else, they just were not in a position to sustain those losses anymore. And so here they are. And one other piece, of course, is that they're looking to sell DirecTV, which would get them out of the pay TV business entirely. And that could end up resulting in, I don't know, something like a $40 billion write-down or $40 billion loss compared to what they paid for DirecTV whenever it was, like 5 years ago. When, yeah, did they acquire, yeah, DirecTV? Yeah. Like 2015, I think, something like that.
So, but it wouldn't get them out of the pay TV business entirely, because they would still be left with AT&T TV.
Right.
But
I
got to tell you, you know, this is a product that I think really is not wanted by consumers. There's plenty of pay TV services that they can sign up for, yeah, if they want them. There's virtual MVPD services that are monthly commitments that they can get for less than they would have to pay for AT&T TV. And AT&T TV requires a 2-year commitment. I don't know what they're doing.
Just to interrupt for a second, Kai, I think they may have now this week offered a month-to-month option for AT&T TV.
Really? I didn't see that. I was on their site the other, yeah, day, and it still said 2-year commitment.
I think I was on there the other day also. I think I may have seen that, but I could be mistaken, but I thought I saw a month-to-month, yeah, option. One way or the other, there's a lot of competition at that level now.
There is.
And certainly a 2-year, and the 2-year also, I think, required some hardware, set-top box, rental. That's a non-starter in the day of, you know, Hulu and with live TV and YouTube TV, et cetera. So,
yeah,
so it's been a murky journey for them for sure.
It sure has. But you know what? I think we're just about out of time, Will. We've talked about two big topics today, and
yep,
as usual, a fun conversation.
Likewise, Colin, good chatting. And thanks, everyone, for listening on this week's edition of our Video News and Screen Media podcast. We appreciate it. And we will see you all again next week.